ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतिकां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी.
Chapter 7.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Mya Saktamana Partha Yogam Yujan Madashriyah Asamshayam Samagrammam Yathajnasyasi Tachranu Mayi Asakta Manaha Partha Yogam Yunjan Mud for Mud Ashriyaha Asamshayam Samagrammam Yathajnasyasi Tachranu. In the previous verse, the last verse of chapter 6, in a way is a bridge to the first two chapter 7. In chapter 7, and really from chapter 7 through 12, the whole emphasis is going to be on the nature of Ishwara, gaining the direct, immediate knowledge of Ishwara. Now you can have jnanam, which means knowledge of Ishwara, like indirect knowledge of Ishwara, and also vijnanam, a parocha jnanam of Ishwara, because in fact you are Ishwara from the standpoint of the Atma. And so this whole, whereas the first six chapters were on the twampada, the nature of the jiva as being and the Atma, now it's on the nature of the Ishwara, and the direct immediate recognition really of yourself as Ishwara, that the aparoksha jnanam of the self of Ishwara, which is yourself. And so it's really nice for us to sit in this now. So anyway, the last verse of chapter 6 leads into this. In this verse he says, among all of the yogis, means among all of those who are, all of the sannyasis, all of those who are the mumukshas, all of the people who are centered, who are after me, we're wanting liberation. So among all of those people, the one who has Shraddha, right? The one who has Shraddha, who serves me or who is committed to me with a mind, that person whose mind is totally focused on me, Madgatena, whose mind is focused on me, centered on me, that person who is committed to me, he, in my opinion, is yukta tamaha, means the most exalted of those who are making this effort. Right? So he is the most exalted. So now, here the Krishna is talking about himself as the Lord. So all of the yogis, that one who is devoted to me, who has Shraddha, means Shraddha, it's going to be Shraddha in the Vedas, Shraddha, that there is even a God. Right? So Shraddha in Ishwara, Shraddha in the Vedas, and with that Shraddha, that person who is committed to me, that person, in my opinion, is the most exalted among all of the yogis. And so now we go into chapter 7. Bhagavan didn't have chapters. He was just teaching. So, okay, you know, Arjuna, let's begin chapter 7. It's a dialogue. He's just talking to him. So now Bhagavan says, You know, Sri Bhagavan Vacha, Bhagavan says, "Hey Paritha," another name for Ishwara, for Arjuna. He says, "Mayi asakta manaha." Those whose mind, for those for whom the manas, the mind, is asakta, means committed, attached. Asakti means attachment. So those for whom the manas, the mind, is asakta, is attached to me. It's committed to me. Right? So that's where the attachment is, that's where the devotion is, where the love is. So those whose mind is attached to me. Yogam yujan, those people who are doing yoga. It means they're trying to gain this jnana-nishtha, they're trying to gain knowledge. Doing yoga, or engaged in yoga, means engaged in this whole process of gaining jnana-nishtha, of gaining self-knowledge. So for those who are engaged, being committed to this process, those whose minds are attached to me, and mud ashriyaha, those for whom I am the ashriya. Now you can take here, Shankar takes this a little differently. There's technically, if that thing which is an ashriya for you is the thing which helps you achieve what you want. And so Swamiji uses the example, I think Shankar uses this example too. In any case, this is that one example of it. Doing the Agnihotra, for instance, can lead to something like Swargaloka. So that Agnihotra, that you become devoted to the doing that Agnihotra so that you can get this particular gain. Well, here, the ashraya is me, Ishwar. The Krishna is talking. Those for whom I am the ashraya, I am the means, and I am also the thing that you're devoted to. I say that you're committed to. So say, for instance, I'm committed to gaining Swargaloka, gaining the heaven world. That's my commitment. That's what I want. That's my desire. That's where my that asakta is there, that attachment, that commitment is there to gaining Swargaloka. Then the ashraya for me is the performance, daily performance of the Agnihotra. Right? So I'm doing this and doing this and doing this in order to build up punya, to accrue punya, so that I'll have enough punya to take me there, to that heavenly world. Where here is different. The ashraya is Ishwara, and the one that I'm committed to is Ishwara. The reason for this, you see, there's no difference, there's no means that is separate from the result, is the idea. There's no means separate from the result. Because in fact, you already are Ishwara. And so there's not going to be anything or any way to take you to Ishwara. There's no place for you to go. And so the commitment now is going to be my whole devotion, what I want to gain, is Ishwara. And how am I going to gain that? Through Ishwara. So my commitment is to myself. How am I going to gain that? Through myself. What does this mean? It's a kind of a fancy way of saying, you know. When we go into the Anubandha Chatushtaya, remember the Anubandha Chatushtaya that we're working on in the Vedanta Sara? In the Anubandha Chatushtaya, there's always a study of, you know, why are you studying something? Like, for instance, I could say, you know, why would you study doing the Agnihotra ritual? Why would you study it? You have to know what you're going to get out of it. That thing that you're going to get out of it is what we call the prayojana, the reason for your studying it. The thing, the subject matter would be the Agnihotra. I'm going to study this ritual. Why? So that I can get this particular result, which would be Swargaloka. You see? So now I know the subject matter, and I know the result, the reason that I'm studying it. Then I would have to know, am I qualified to study it? Am I the type of person that be qualified to do that study, you know, in order to gain this result. So, you know, that becomes the adhikari. These are all things you have to understand when you're studying anything. But now here, say with the Agnihotra, I'm studying the Agnihotra ritual so that I can get Swargaloka. Right? Now the question is, what is the relationship between the study of the Agnihotra ritual and Swargaloka? Will the study of the ritual give me Swargaloka? And we say no. The study of the ritual won't give you Swargaloka. It will tell you how to do the ritual, which will then accrue punya, which will help you to gain Swargaloka. So I have to know what the relationship is between what I'm studying and what I'm going to get. Right? Now here in self-knowledge, it's a little bit different than that. Because now, what am I studying? I'm gaining self-knowledge. Why do I want to study this? Why am I studying, say, the Upanishad in order to gain self-knowledge? I'm studying the Upanishad because the Upanishad is the means for giving me self-knowledge. Okay, now the Upanishad, I study the Upanishad, it gives me self-knowledge. Now, what is the result? Now that the Upanishad, what it does is it gives me self-knowledge. Now what? If I study the Agnihotra ritual, that doesn't do anything. I study the ritual, and then I have to do something in order to put that ritual to work. So another example is I study cooking. I study a cookbook. Does that give me the meal? No, I have to do something. So now I study the Upanishad. I expose myself to that teaching. The Upanishad itself gives self-knowledge. So now, okay, I've studied the Upanishad. That's the subject matter. I'm the adhikari. I'm the qualified student. Why am I the qualified student? What makes me a qualified student is that I want to gain self-knowledge. Why do I want to gain self-knowledge? Because I want liberation. Okay. I want to study self-knowledge because I want moksha, I want liberation. So moksha is the pola, right? So I'm studying the Upanishad, I'm being taught the Upanishad, so that I can gain self-knowledge, so that I can gain liberation. That's the pola. What is the relationship between the self-knowledge that the Upanishad gives and the pola, the moksha, that I want to gain? You see, it's a big question. Some people will say, well, the Upanishad gives you some self-knowledge and then you have to go meditate on it to what? To gain the self, to what? So here, this is what Krishna is going to be talking about here. The knowledge is the result. That's the thing. The knowledge is the pola. Because it comes down to this. You're either a limited jiva. You're either a limited jiva by your nature, separate from the whole. In which case, there's not going to be anything that you can do about it. Right? If you're by your nature, by your swarupa, by your very nature, yourself, you are limited. And the whole of you is part of the whole of you as a limited jiva. You are part and parcel of the whole of Ishwara. That's your nature. Now, if that's your nature, when you gain knowledge of your nature, what will you know? You'll know exactly what you knew before, that I am a limited individual, separate from, you know, part of the whole. And so, in that case, what would your liberation be? If, in fact, your nature is limited, what would your liberation be?
More samsara.
There's no liberation. There isn't any liberation. You have to decide what is the best that I can do within this limited sphere. And that's what the Karmakanda is. That's exactly what the first portion of the Vedas is about. If you take yourself to be a jiva, if that's your reality, right, what you believe, you know, and you're a samsari and you want to gain happiness from the world, then this is the best way to do it. If you're limited and the ananda is outside of what you seek is outside of yourself, then follow dharma, perform these rituals, live within this structured type of a life, understand these few things, and it will be the best possible way to live in this world with the least amount of pain. This is how to live dharmically in this world with the least amount of pain. That's the first part of the Vedas. You're still living a limited life because that's your nature. So now, what if, though, on the other hand, your nature, in fact, is not limited? What about if, in fact, your nature is whole? That you are Ishwara, that you are the whole, that your being is changeless, is limitless, is the very being that's the truth of the whole creation. What if that's the reality? Then what's the problem? If that's the reality, what is the problem? Well, the problem is that you don't know it. And that's why you're an adhikara, you become a student. You, the student, wants to gain knowledge, right? Why do you want to gain knowledge? Because there's self-ignorance. Okay, so now, say you gain that knowledge through the unfoldment of the Upanishad. You gain the knowledge. Then what? Is there something to do, is the question. If you gain the knowledge, is there something more to do? Because if the problem for your bondage is one of ignorance, right? If the problem of your bondage is one of ignorance, and the ignorance is removed, then there's no more problem. And so that makes it a very interesting relationship between the knowledge of the self and the result of that knowledge. That's why we say self-knowledge itself is liberation. And the reason that we say that self-knowledge itself is liberation, is because yourself is already free. It's not something that can be improved upon. You already are Ishwara. And so if you are Ishwara and you don't know you're Ishwara, there's not a thing you can do about that. You can do hundreds and thousands of things, but you're still going to have the same problem that you're limited. Right? And so the limited person is working to gain all kinds of experiences, make all kinds of improvements, self-improvements, maturation, growth, all kinds of things that are not bad in themselves. They're good in themselves. Right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with becoming more mature. There's certainly nothing wrong with solving our complexes and things that are causing us pain. There's nothing wrong with doing yoga and eating healthy food. These are all positive things, and they take care of relative problems. But they don't take care of the fundamental problem of myself as a limited being who's eating well, doing yoga, meditating, and becoming mature. I'm still a limited being who's doing all of these things. Right? And so the fundamental problem is not touched at all. But you can go on becoming more and more mature, psychologically, spiritually mature. You can go on becoming more and more and more saintly. You can go on becoming more, ridding yourself more and more of your psychological complexes and traumas and emotional pain. These are all very positive things. But in the end, that person who has become mature through the yin-yang will finally end up in exactly the same place. Please give me knowledge of myself. Who am I? What is the truth? There's a wonderful story about I'll think of his name. He knows everything. So many stories are told about this Narada. He knows so much. You know, he has knowledge of so many different shastras, so many life experiences. And finally, he goes to the to a guru, his guru, and he says, I know this, and I know this, and I know this, and I know this, and I know this, but there's something I don't know. What is that? What is that that I don't know, you know? I don't know myself. I don't know that what makes all of this meaningful. Even though I have all this vast amounts of knowledge, please teach me, you know? Please, and I'm bringing this up now because Krishna is going to bring this up. Please teach me, you know, that thing knowing which everything is well known. Please teach me that. That I don't know. So the thing is, you can know so much in the universe, and you can have so many skills and so many talents, and you can develop such wisdom and saintliness and maturity, but all you're doing is becoming more and more of an adhikari for this knowledge. More and more of a qualified student for this knowledge. You've cleared out more and more pratibandhakas that are just causing you problems. But it hasn't touched the fundamental problem of my own sense of separateness, my sense of isolation, my sense of being limited and being incomplete, my sense of not being loved, cared for, adored. People don't walk around saying, I want to be loved and adored. But, you know, honestly, that is what your heart needs. It needs to feel that it's that you're loved. A little child, a little baby, in those first few years of life, what makes that child able to really have a happy life is that the parents adored it with all full concentrated adoration on the little, as Freud would call, the little king. The little king or queen in the middle of the room. It soaks up and soaks up adoration. And that's why, you know, people, I even joke about it, like if you go to somebody's house and their child, they have a child, their little child, we either get into the adoration, you know, and enjoy that, you know, and join the parents with their adoration of their child, you know, or we can't really be part of what's of the reality of that situation. People joke about it all of the time, right? And so if somehow you're not able to join in with that, with the parents in that type of love where the child is in the center, then you won't be able to really be part of it, to really be there, because that's how kind of integral it is. You know, it's archetypal in a way. So we need to somehow be able to, in a relative way, assimilate that adoration. We take it in, as an interject, you know, so that we're being fed in a relative way, that part of ourselves is being held and handled by that type of care and type of love. And of course, Kali Yuga. Yeah. Most people have not gotten that relatively to a strong, a high degree. And so part of the task, even in giving self-knowledge, is learning how to make up for that. You know, because we need, even on a relative level, to feel loved, to feel cared for, to feel mirrored, you know, and to agree we don't have a self-structure. Self-structure means psychologically, self-structure inside that's holding that. You're more and more dependent on getting it from the outside and more threatened by the outside world not giving it to you because it's absolutely essential, you know. And so we have to learn how to give that to ourselves through inner child work and all of this type of thing, you know. Okay, that's just on a relative level. But so where I'm going here is that the nature of your being is that which is the beloved. That is the nature of the Atma. The Atma is the beloved. Okay. Now, unless you feel that sense of beloved, what are you? See what I mean? If your mind is such that because of its complexes or because of its or because of my externalized needs, I need this to be happy, I need that to be happy, I need this person to be this way to me, I need that person to be that way to me. My mind isn't reflecting that state of feeling loved, of feeling that beloved, having that beloved nature inside. If I don't feel that beloved nature, which another way of saying this, if I don't feel internally loved, then I don't feel complete. And I don't feel complete because the nature of the self is that is loved, or is, I mean, I can use that word, I don't want you to superimpose it onto a lot of external types of loving, but it's that sense of being loved, of being held, of being whole. If you say, I want to be complete, I want to be whole, I want to be loved, I want to be able to say, all is well with me. I want to be able to say that because, in fact, that is who I am. And when the mind is in an altered state where it is feeling stress or tension or superimposing itself in one way or another onto the world, that isn't the feeling of the mind. The feeling of the mind is I feel lonely, or I feel isolated, or I feel incomplete, or I feel hurt, or I feel so many things, none of which are okay. All of those states of mind are not okay. Those are states of mind that we try to change. And we become more sophisticated in the ways that we try to change them. Right? And so in the end, what does the mind have to realize? You know, where does the mind have to end up? It has to end up in this mai asakta manaha. The mind has to itself end up in a place where its attachment or its commitment or its devotion is to that beloved self. Not to the ego, not to the body, not to the mind, not to the sense organs, but to the very nature of the body, mind, sense organs, the very jiva, the very jiva means the very self of the jiva. And when the mind, that's when the mind feels that it has come home. And what is it that the mind is attached to? And what is the ashraya? What is the means for helping the mind attain that? Krishna says, it's me, it's Ishwara. Right? It's recognizing everything as the Lord. So he's going to go on and develop this. So he says, for those people whose attachment is in toward me, who are doing this yoga, who are committed to me, who use me to get there, he says, listen to me, Arjuna, Tatshrinu. Listen to me, He Partha. I will tell you, he says, listen to me. I will make you know, I will teach you, I will make you know me, just as I am. Asamshayam samagram, he says, without any doubt and wholly. I will give you knowledge of how I am, of who I am, wholly, completely, and free from doubt. So he says, let's do the next verse, these two go together. Jnanam teham savijnanam, jnanam teham savijnanam, idam vaksham yasheshataha, idam vaksham yasheshataha, yajnatva neha bhuyonyat, yajnatva neha bhuyonyat, jnatavyam avishishyate, jnatavyam avishishyate, jnanam te aham savijnanam, idam vakshami asheshataha yat jnatva na iha bhuyaha anyat jnatavyam avashishyate. It says, I will tell you completely Aham bhakshami asheshataha. I'm going to tell you completely without leaving. Asheshataha means without leaving anything out. I'm going to tell you this completely. Tell you what? I'm going to give you this knowledge to you. This jnanam. This knowledge. Savignanam. Together, not just the knowledge. Together with the vignanam. Means I'm going to make you, I'll make you understand Ishvara, but I'm also going to give you aparoksha jnanam of Ishvara. I'm going to make you see it. Not just know it, understand it intellectually. I'm going to make you see it as I see it. I'm make at the very vision that I have as I see it, I'm going to make you see it. I'm going to give you direct, not just indirect knowledge, so that you can have a picture of Ishvara painted for you. I'm going to make you have direct, immediate knowledge of that too. So he says, and that having known which, having gained which, that knowledge having known which, na iha bhuyaha anyat jnatavyam, he says, there isn't anything else to be known. Avishesha, completely, there is no other thing. Having known which, there's nothing else that needs to be known. Jnatavyam means is to be known. There is nothing else to be known. Knowing which there's nothing else to be known. That knowledge I'm going to give you. So, this theme comes throughout the Upanishads, knowing which there's nothing else to be known. So he has to gain aparoksha jnanam of Ishvara, right? Because we don't usually think of gaining aparoksha jnanam of Ishvara. We should be thinking of it, but we don't. Sometimes we think, if I understand Ishvara, I have indirect knowledge of Ishvara. Why? Because if I gain knowledge of Ishvara, Ishvara is limitless. I am limited. This body, mind, sense organs is limited. My sphere of experience is limited. I don't know all of the heaven and hell worlds. I don't even know, you know, what's 50 miles from me. I have no idea. And so my knowledge is limited. Ishvara's knowledge is limitless. So how can I can gain indirect knowledge of Ishvara? I can appreciate Ishvara. I can have Shraddha in the Shastra and appreciate the cyclical nature of the creation as the Shastra reveals. I can appreciate all of the heaven and hell worlds. I can appreciate Ishvara as infinite knowledge. But how can I have direct, immediate knowledge of Ishvara? How is that possible? It's possible through knowing who Ishvara is. Right? It's like saying, in reference to the jiva, in reference to gaining self-knowledge in reference to you, the jiva, it's one thing to gain knowledge of your body, which of course you can never gain complete knowledge of your body. You can never even gain complete knowledge of a leaf. Sometimes that example is used. If you have just, say, one little leaf, How many lifetimes, if ever, to gain complete knowledge of that leaf? Right? How many lifetimes, if ever, to gain knowledge of the mind or the sense organs or any part, any of the components that make you up? So you don't even have to think of infinite Ishvara, gaining knowledge, gaining understanding of infinite Ishvara, infinite creation. Take even the smallest little piece of paper. How to gain infinite knowledge of that? Because everything that you look at, everything that you experience in the creation is infinitely divisible. And so then, in fact, in Maya, there is no possibility of gaining knowledge of anything in the creation that is full and complete, because everything is infinitely divisible and continually changing. You can't do it. And yet, what is the substance, what is the being of this infinite creation? Or what is the being of the leaf? Or what is the being of my body? Or what is the being of my sense organs? Or the being of my mind? What is the self? Who is the self? Who is the self of this body? Who is the conscious being that indwells this body? What is the existence that this enjoys, the being that it enjoys? Can you gain knowledge of that or not? We would say actually, in one sense, the truth of the whole thing is the only thing you can gain knowledge of. Everything else, in terms of duality, everything that exists within creation, the knowledge that you gain is a mithyajnanam. We can look at mithya jnanam in different ways. For one thing, any knowledge that you gain in the creation is infinitely divisible. Right? And so where is the knowledge? Where is the thing that you're trying to get knowledge of? You can't do it. But now what about the nature of the Atma, the nature of the Self, the nature of you? Can you gain knowledge of yourself or not? Only if you're not two. If you're not divisible, right? If you're divisible, if your being is divisible, there's no end to the division. If your being is not divisible, then there's only one thing to be known. And it doesn't matter from what angle. There is no angle, right? So in terms of consciousness, there's no angle. There's no up, there's no down, there's no backside, there's no front side, there's no side. And so the knowledge of yourself, the knowledge of being itself, is total and complete. It's only one thing. It can only be one thing. It doesn't have any sides. And so that one thing is what needs to be understood. And knowing that one thing, everything is as well known. In fact, you could say, knowing that one thing, everything becomes known. Knowing all of this, nothing is known. Like for you as a jiva, knowing all of this, nothing is really known. Right? Knowing that one thing, which is the self of all of this, then that is known completely. And all of this is known completely. That's the same example of using the waves and the waves in the ocean. If you know the water, you know what is there. You know, if you take all of the examples they use, if you take all of the gold chains, the gold is there. If you know the gold, you know what is there. All of the clay pots, if you know the clay, you know what is there. The ocean, you know the water, you know what is there. Here, you know the Atma, you know what is there. It's easy when you think of waves, ocean, to recognize if you know the water, you know what is there. You have to be able to see the self in the same way. That to recognize all of this as the self. In the same way that if I look at the ocean, I recognize that it's water. It's almost the same. This is what's different. If I look at the ocean and I see, oh, all of these names and forms are nothing but water. This is how that drishtanta breaks down. I'm looking at the waves and form, though I'm looking at all the names and forms in terms of the waves, I'm looking at it. I'm also looking at the water. Right? Both things are happening through my eyes. Here, both things are not happening through my eyes. And this is what Krishna is going to be sitting with. This is the whole knowledge. When I'm looking out at you, right, through my eyes, I'm seeing the names and forms. But the names and forms that I'm seeing through my eyes are infinitely divisible. In other words, they're all conglomerates. This is made up of of the pole and the lamp and the knob, etc. But anything that I look at with my eyes, I can't grasp, I can't find it, I can't find something there. Right? So I can't, put it this way, I can't see the water. When I'm looking out here, I can't see a substance. If I look at the ocean, I can see, oh look, all those names and forms are there, and they're all water, right? I'm seeing the water. Now what about here? I'm looking at all of these names and forms through my eyes. Am I seeing being? Am I seeing the Satchit as I'm looking at all of these things? Say no. I'm seeing names and forms. If I look at the cedar chest there, I'm seeing the name and form cedar chest, and I'm seeing its content wood. But the wood isn't the content of the rug, and the wood isn't the content of the space. So say, if I want to see what is the being of all of these things that I'm looking at, am I going to be seeing it through my eyes? You say, no, you're not going to be seeing it through your eyes, because If we're looking for the common denominator, the content that's the substance of everything that we're experiencing, it's not going to be something that I can objectify. It has to be something which, in fact, as much as you are, I am. If I'm looking for the water, say if in this, here, this room, say there's nothing, it's nothing but water, right? It's nothing but water here. Are you going to be able to look at the water? Because everything about you is the water. There's nothing that's not the water. You know, like the waves themselves, they're going to be able to look at the forms. But they can't look at the water because they are the water. And so here in this situation, I can look at, through my sense organs, all of the names and forms, but I can't look at the thing that all of that, that which all of this is, the water that all of this is. And the water that all of this is me. It has to be me. Because I'm the conscious being, you know, I'm the conscious being that is the self of the body. I see this body's conscious, the conscious being. My sense organs are a conscious being. My mind is a conscious being. Everything that I perceive takes place in consciousness. And so I am this conscious being. Can I look at it? No. You can look at names and forms. But do the names and forms that you look at, are they away from conscious being? No. There's nothing away from conscious being. But I can't look at it. I am it. See what I mean? I can't look at it. I am it. And so now what I have to do, there has to be a teaching methodology that comes along and holds up a mirror to the self, which is the self-evident subject of all of your experience. And so this here, this is now what Krishna is saying. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you this knowledge together with vijnanam, the vishesha jnanam, the direct immediate recognition, knowing which everything is, nothing else needs to be known. That's what I'm going to make you see now, he says. Okay. And he says, I'm going to make you see it completely. Manushanam sahasreshu, manushanam sahasreshu, kaschit yatati siddhaye, kaschit yatati siddhaye, yatatam api siddhanam, yatatam api siddhanam, kaschin mam veti tatvataha, kaschin mam veti tatvataha, manushanam sahasreshu, kaschit yatati siddhaye, yatatam api siddhanam, kaschit mam veti tatvataha. Now he says, manushanam sah, now he's praising Arjuna, making Arjuna feel important. He says, manushanam sahasreshu, among the thousands of human beings that are there, like the one in the million, Swamiji said, among the thousands of human beings that are there, kaschit, just someone, yatati siddhiye, strives for moksha. Siddhiya means moksha. Yatati makes efforts. Among all the thousands of beings that are human beings, only one, only some one rare person makes, strives for moksha. Then he says, yatatam api siddhanam. He says, and among those who are striving for moksha, those ones that are seeking, or those ones who are making effort for moksha, kaschit mam veti tatvataha. Only one, some rare one, knows me in reality. So he says, there are thousands of people. This is like in the Viveka Chudamani. Same idea. It also runs through the Upanishads. It's praising the Adhikari, praising the Mumukshu. Of all, there's so many beings, thousands and thousands of beings. So among the thousands of beings in the humans, that are there, only some rare one will strive to know me, will want to know me, will make the effort to know me. And among those, all of those siddhas, all of those who are making that effort, only some rare one will know me in reality, will get to know me. So Swamiji, when Swamiji's commentated on this, he says, now he's not, he's trying to make Arjuna feel special, not discourage him. Because you could say, you know, you can imagine Arjuna thinking, oh my God. First you'll feel special, like when, you know, when he says, among all of the thousands, only some rare person would make any effort to know me. And then Arjuna can think, like me. I'm making an effort now. You know, I'm making an effort. You know, and I want this. But then Krishna says, and among all of those who make an effort, only one really knows me in truth. You know? So then Arjuna, Swamiji was afraid Arjuna might feel discouraged, or he might feel it's not for that. It's to really start to point out the subtlety, really, the subtlety of this knowledge. Because you are what you seek. What you are seeking, the knowledge that you are seeking, is of the one that you are, of the one that is already absolutely present. It's the self is hidden in the seeker, right? What you are, the sought is hidden in the seeker. And it's such an unusual situation because you already know yourself in terms of your experience. The what we call the general samanya jnanam is already there, where you say, yeah, I am me. I am a conscious, sentient being. I am this body, mind, sense organs. I am so and so and so and so, and I am doing this and that and this and that. This I that you're referring to is Brahman. There's not another I. This very I that you're referring to when you say, you know, I'm going to walk to the store and I have to study this and I'm feeling tired and I think I'll have some cherries. You know? Let's come in. Okay. All of these things, you know, you're actually the self you're referring to as the locus of the ahankara that's saying, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. It is that self that is Ishwara. That self that is Brahman. And so this is the very unusual situation, because we only think of gaining knowledge in terms of gaining an experience and then getting to know the ins and outs of that experience. You know, now I gain a vision of that painting, and then I can learn all about, I see the painting, and so now I can learn all about the painting, right? And so now in my think of, let me gain self-knowledge. Okay, well, I have to gain the self, the experience of the self, and then I can learn about that. Well, that's not the situation here. You already are the experience of the self. It's not an experience to be gained. It's a given. It is already completely here. And so the very me that you're completely attached to as yourself, that you have identified by your name, and you have a different name than I have, right? So what you take to be you, and you've named it, and you look at yourself in the mirror, right? So you've named yourself, and you're attached to that self, and you don't want that self to die. It is that self which you've named as you that is, in fact, Ishwara. It is that self that's the self of the whole creation. It's that self that is myself, that is yourself. That is the very being in which this whole creation exists. And so to recognize that, it's like, you know, we use this praptasya prapti. It's the attainment of the attained. This knowledge, you know, is the attainment of the attainment of the attained, the gain of what is already gained, the recognition of what is already being experienced. So we don't know, we don't think about knowledge like that. We think about knowledge of gaining an experience and learning about the experience that we've gained. And always in terms of self-knowledge also, we think about it like that. Let me gain a meditative experience. Now when I have that meditative experience, you know, then I can say, now I've achieved there's different things I'll say. Now I've achieved that. I have that meditative experience, that samadhi experience. And now I have to keep it because I've achieved an experience. So now I can think, well, now I have to hold this experience that I've achieved. But the self isn't an experience to be gained. It's the one that is illumining this samadhi experience. And it's the one that is there when the samadhi experience goes away. So I can think, and so that's one way. That's more of a yogic way of looking at it. A neo-Vedantic way of looking at it is that I have to gain this experience that the Upanishads are talking about. Right? The Upanishads are unfolding all about this experience. And so now I've heard about it, I've studied it, I've learned about it. And so now, indirect knowledge. And so now let me go meditate to try to have the direct, immediate recognition of what these Upanishads are talking about. And so again, I become experience-oriented. That's why it's so important to recognize Vedanta as a pramana. Pramana means the Upanishads are right here and now, pointing to the experience that is right here and now, to help you to recognize your own nature right here and now. And then when we do nididhyasana and meditation, it's so that my mind can sit in that recognition. Right? What I've recognized at the time of teaching, then through meditation I can contemplate on that, I can meditate upon it, but I'm meditating upon something that I've recognized. Right? Not a new experience. I've recognized the truth of the experience that is already here. And now since my mind is so used to working the world in the world of duality, I now give it a chance to pull it back in and recognize this being that I am as the self in all beings, for instance. Or to just recognize this being as being free from all name and form, of being changeless. So I use meditation to recognize these things that I see at the time of teaching. Otherwise, I'm on a trip, you know. And so most, what he's saying, you know, it is very tough. Even all of the people who seek me, thousands, of all of the thousands of people, you know, of all of the thousands of people that are there, only one will even think, you know, to seek me or to gain this knowledge, to gain moksha. And then of all of those who are trying to gain liberation, only one rare one knows who I am in reality. Because in reality, I am you. I am you. That's the truth of it. Or if you don't like it to be said that way, you could say that instead of saying I am God, you can say God, the God or the Brahman is me. Right? Brahman is the self. Brahman is yourself. You could say yourself is Brahman. Brahman is yourself. You know? That's the recognition. Now, in that recognition, you're not going to have an experience of a new self. You'll recognize the freedom of the self that you are. See that it's subtle. You don't experience a new self. You recognize the freedom of the self that is there. And you see the mityatva. In that recognition, you see the mityatva of everything else, the changing nature of everything else, and the stability of yourself, the self that you can't do anything about, and you recognize that as the self and the self of all beings. But you're recognizing yourself as the self of all beings, not in terms of a different experience of yourself, but you're recognizing that this experience of yourself is that. The very experience of yourself that you are right now is that, which is much different than trying to gain another experience. So let's stop there. I'm kind of tired tonight, so I'm having a hard time. But this is good for an introduction. Actually, Krishna is introducing the subject matter in these verses. Let's just take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
What do you do with yourself when you do say that I need to experience myself? I mean,
Well, if you already know yourself, that's a good time to do some nididhyasana, just to pull your mind back home. Yeah.
And sit there.
Yeah. In fact, you learn how to do that in just a split second.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we think we have to sit and meditate for an hour, which is nice. That's a good practice if you can find, if you have the desire, and you know, you can do that nididhyasana, kind of a daily routine. It's a beautiful thing. But you can also do it throughout the day in split seconds throughout the day. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have to wait to sit. It's something that you do spontaneously throughout the day, and that can be part of your meditative practice.
What?
And it's especially useful whenever your mind is causing you pain.
Well, when you're living throughout the day, I don't really see myself noticing that I'm just...
Well, that's why you make some discipline for yourself. Like, even at the beginning of the day, you can say something like, whatever works for you, but you can say mm-hmm. something. All right, so at so many times during the day, I'm just going to pull myself back.
Just for that moment.
Yeah.
And see that I'm not what I'm doing, I'm not this Upadi, I'm not what I'm thinking, I'm not this activity.
Or however you do, you recognize yourself in Ishwara. You just stop for a minute. You can just do it in a split second.
Yeah.
So you have to, but you have to make that decision.
I have to decide to make that recognition.
You have to decide. Otherwise, you're just lost in samsara.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, that's sadhana, you can make that decision. And then you'll find that it's no longer a decision, it's just something you always do.
Mm-hmm.
Because the commitment is to Bhagavan, the commitment is to Ishwara, your relationship. That's another thing about that maya sakta manaha. Your relationship and the love and the commitment is to Ishwara. What is Ishwara is this? Everything that you find yourself in, this whole creation itself is Ishwara. And so then you start more and more appreciating, you know, kind of the, you learn more and more about who Ishwara is. Just like if you're in a relationship with your partner, you go on learning more and more and more about your partner. What about your partner is Ishwara? You know? No, I'm serious. You know, your partner is Ishwara. So that's where your commitment is. That's where your shraddha is. That's where your understanding, your growth is. You know? And at the same time, then that's looking at the Ishwara Upadhi. What about just the nature of Ishwara is your own being? So
well,
it's the Satya Mitya.
Yeah, I just one more thing. I almost feel like I'm a little lazy about it. Is that why it doesn't occur more often? Is that,
well,
it's not, I don't have a resistance. It just kind of, I'm going downstream, floating through all this.
Well, maybe you're just starting to become aware of that, and to the point of getting ready to make some sort of spend more time on your knowledge throughout the day,
mm-hmm.
where it becomes more of a priority.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So maybe you're getting to a place where you want to do that.
Okay. You know, Carol, you said, like, if you see something, you don't see the set shift, you know, you don't see it. Like you see
through your eyes, you are.
Yeah, you don't. But in another sense, you wouldn't see anything except for that. Do you know what I mean? I mean, like the rug. Okay, that's a form and colors and all these things. But it is and is known and it's revealed because of consciousness. And so, in a sense, though you don't see it as an object,
it's self-evident.
Yeah,
that's right. You don't see it as an object through the sense organs, but it's the self-evident being that is there.
Right. But you're seeing the objects.
Right.
Because of the self-evident.
That's true.
Right.
That's true. But that self-evident being isn't objectified. It's the truth of everything.
Yeah.
But it's not an object.
Right. But it's the truth of the object.
It's the truth of the object.
Right.
Right. But it's not seen. What your eyes see is color.
Yeah.
Right? What your ears hear is sound.
But you know how Swamiji will say, you know, it's an attribute or like an adjective that doesn't change the substantive.
Yeah.
In a way, so...
Well...
Or quality.
But that's not negating at all what I'm saying. Like if I say this chair is,
yeah.
It has there's chair existence.
Right.
This is, you know, lamp existence.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But the existence, if you were to say, do you see some existence there?
Yeah.
No. Why do you know that there's exist? Why do you know this is lamp existence? Where is the existence in it that you're experiencing? That's yourself. That's the self-evident nature of you. That is there's only one existence experience, which is your being.
Mm-hmm.
And it's self-evident. That's why, in a way, you feel like you're seeing it, perhaps, because there's no place that self-evident being is not.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not yeah. There's no subject-object there.
Yeah. And I don't really feel like I'm seeing it per se, but it's more like everything is it, so...
Everything is it. Maybe you want to say it differently than how I'm saying it right now.
I don't know. I'm just trying to think about it. You know, if everything is it, then in a sense, you are kind of saying it. I mean, in a way, because
if
everything's it, then what else are you seeing? You're seeing name and form, but what is it name and form of?
Yeah, that's right. But you have to somehow in teaching, you have to be able to see that which is the same in this and this and this and this. In other words, the self of this, you, is the self of the rug, is the self of this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so what in your eyes are allowing you to see that which is the same, the summitvam in all of this. Once you see that, once you recognize that the only thing here is consciousness, and that's aproksha to you, then obviously everything you see is only that. But until that's been recognized, everything you see is not that. A rug is not the chair. You know?
Mm.
And you're not seeing the oneness.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're only seeing diversity.
Right.
So the recognition of the oneness isn't something that you recognize through your eyes. It's the differentiation of the approach itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you see that there is nothing that's separate from that.
I have a question regarding meditation.
Yeah.
And maybe you could speak to it a little bit, briefly.
Mm-hmm.
I try to be careful not to have any, like my mantra is, no new experiences. I don't want any new experiences, you know. And one of the things that happens is emotional experiences will come up. And it'll be pleasant, emotional, just that sense of well-being. But I kind of tamp that down because I notice that I'm trying to define things with my senses or my emotional sense of defining it, you know. And yet, I think there's a truth in that emotion. It's probably, I don't know, it's a little confusing for me.
Well,
the emotional aspect, even though it's pleasant, is...
One thing that's really helpful, I think, to do is to make use of those pleasant, like, say if you're meditating and your mind is having some ananda, it's relaxed and it's feeling that wholeness and that, you know, fullness. A nice thing to do, and the reason it's doing it is because, feeling that, is because the mind has become kind of absorbed and quiet. It has some shanti. So that's a beautiful thing. So in from that state, then you can just go deeper to the nature of the one that's illuminating that fullness. And actually that'll create more fullness. The very me that's present to that fullness. You just keep focusing on that. And then there's probably more fullness. Then it's just, well, the me that's, you know, present to that. And then you just keep relaxing and relaxing and relaxing without trying to hold on to it. Yeah. Because what you're doing is just getting more and more of a shantavritti. And as long as when that shantavritti is there, the mind is going to be enjoying fullness and ananda and happiness because it's reflecting in that quiet mind. But what you can do to take it deeper is not be worried about that. You just totally let it be. And then just, again, be aware of the one that's aware of it. And differentiate between the one who's aware of it and that, which is a really kind of a deepening thing to do. You can try. Yeah, we don't want to get rid of the ananda.
No reason for criticism.
but the problem is then when your mind can start chattering, oh, this is so beautiful, this is so wonderful, this is so nice, and be focusing on the ananda this way instead of on the self of the ananda, you know? And so now you become extrovert, illumining to the ananda that you're illumining, the ananda that's being reflected in the mind, instead of the ananda that is your own swarupa, that is your own self. So you just allow that ananda to be and just go relax and then more and more enjoy the nature of yourself that's present to that. And that's a whole different type of ananda. It's a benign ananda that you start to recognize is always there, no matter what the vritti is, no matter what the experience is. That's the ananda, that's the very swarupa, the very nature of yourself. And not, it's not an ananda that comes and goes with the shanta vritti. And so when the shanta vritti is there, you can just totally enjoy that relaxation, but then move inward to the one who's present to it.
So is there a skill then in noticing this this ananda? This well-being, or is it a development of a skill when you're waking or talking?
Edward, when you have a moment of ananda, whether you're meditating or just like if you have a moment of pain, you're aware of it.
Yeah.
Right? It's not no skill. You're aware of it.
Yeah.
Now the thing is, though, if you're meditating, what do you do when you're having, like, what do you do if you have a painful experience? There's different things you can do. You can be with that pain. You can let the pain come and go. Or you can feel this pain is such that it requires some attention. You can go into dialogue with it. So there's a skill in terms of knowing how to be with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now say the ananda comes because the mind is quiet and resolved. Then there's also some things to know about how to be with that in a way that kind of deepens it and takes you more and more to the recognition of an ananda that is free from coming and going.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to say. You know, if can you constantly notice that all is well with me on a constant basis? I mean, you know,
that's the nature of the self.
Yeah.
And so that becomes that once it's differentiated, it's always there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then your mind can still be causing some pain,
mm-hmm.
which you have to work on and help that to mature, but that self that is that constant self is always there no matter what's going on in the mind. And we still work on our mind because it's in pain, it needs some help. You know, if your mind, just like another person, if any person is in pain, it needs some help. Do you help? If your mind is in pain, it needs some help. It's calling for help, right? It wants calling for attention, and so you give it that attention. But the thing is to start learning how to give it attention in a way that really works.
So you said something very interesting. I mean, a lot of things, but this one thing that kind of struck me was like when you said, if you don't feel internally love, you don't feel complete.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just realized that, like, this whole phenomenon of relationship, you know, which is a very interesting phenomenon, where I think two people fundamentally come into a relationship with themselves, realizing that they're looking for exactly that. They're looking for that completion with experiencing somehow being loved. But it's just this mirror thing, and they're kind of looking at in the other one, but it's not really, it's not the true source for somebody.
It's not the true source, yeah. That's right.
So, then that being kind of, that whole field being amplified through the vasanas that two people now bring to that field of experience, it seems like a very difficult endeavor, you know, to really bring that into a fruition or into a true resolution, maybe is the right word, you know, that there's literally that it's not just like vasanas meeting vasanas anymore, but there is that true recognition, what you were just saying, you know, that this wanting, that are looking for the love, but kind of having the skill set to actually find it, you know, or to kind of manifest it. It's like literally, actually, you're not even finding it, you're actually manifesting it through your knowledge, right?
But in a relationship, that's, you know, relationships are like cauldrons in a way, because you're held in the relationship, and then it becomes a sadhana. Mm-hmm. You know, how to give instead of take, mm-hmm. you know, so that you become less dependent on that other person for making you happy. You look at it more that some person that I give to make them happy rather than taking to make me happy.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because the self that you're seeking is already present. The source of Ananda is already present. And so if I use a relationship to try to get the other person to make me happy, I'm working against myself, really. Where is it you're working in a relationship to make the other person happy, you end up also becoming happy. Be happy.
It's a switcheroo.
But now, let's say, you know, you take a mouse and a cat, right? They have a certain affinity, but that affinity doesn't kind of allow for a certain kind of fluidity of movement, you know, in terms of relationship. They have this, they have more like the cat chases, the mouse and eats the mouse and that's it. And it's the end of the story, you know. So now, so these vasanas exist also in, I think, in the world of people. Now, you know, does that make up a incompatible relationship, or is there something, now bringing this back to us as people, that could maybe help us to bring this whole experience to a new place, you know, that the cat actually realizes that the cat and us as people, you know, whether I want to stay with that example, you know, that there's maybe that that a person actually recognizes, wow, you know, in the midst of the conflict of that relationship, there's something to be learned here that goes beyond all the vasanas, and at the same time, it doesn't remain something theoretical. It becomes actually a truth that can be lived. Even though you still have the mouse cat phenomena, that looks like from the outside it's not working. But do you know what I mean?
I think I do.
Yeah. Is that potential? Is that just an illusion? See, that's what I'm trying to find out. Is there actually is incompatibility an illusion that is based on a reductionistic kind of perception, or is incompatibility just part of life that the rose just doesn't hang out with a juniper or something, you know?
Well, I
or a cat doesn't hang out with a mouse,
yeah.
Or two people don't hang out with each other because they ultimately recognize they're just too different. But I can't somehow accept that, you know, that seems like the end of the story. That just seems to me like the beginning of the story for some reason, you know what I mean?
Well, you can, because you can come to a place where the incompatibility is fine, that's the reality.
Right, can one really come to that place? You know, how do I know that?
Well, I think that you probably experienced that many, many times, where the incompatibility is fine, it doesn't bother you at all. But then when you're in a relationship where there's a lot of attachment, then you don't feel that way, because it's all true, it's all very real.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's all so many instances just day to day where you're in situations where there's not a real compatibility. But does it matter? You can be compatible with incompatibility. You don't have to. I mean, just to think of it like this. What if you said, you know, for me to live happily, I can only be in the midst of compatible situations. Wow, I can't.
Good luck.
That's not how it is. You have to not be resisting in a sense. I don't know if we're talking about the same thing.
Well, it's just, you know, I think there's so many nuances to it. I mean, it's
if I go to work, there's so many people that I could say, oh, this person is very different. I'd have no compatibility with that person. It's not somebody I would hang out with or do things with.
Well, you wouldn't, right?
No.
You wouldn't hang out with any person on the street.
There's so many.
Right.
But there's just nothing in common. There's no compatibility there.
Right.
But that doesn't make any difference. I don't care at all.
But you also don't hang out with them.
No. I only go toward things that are incompatible, and that's how the whole world is like that.
Yeah, that's...
But then if you end up in a situation where you're with an incompatible person, like Swamiji and his, you know... chapatis instead of idlis. Something that you're not used to, that's not what you would choose to, you know. But it doesn't matter. It's not as though you become miserable because you're in that situation. But that's not the situation that you would naturally gravitate towards. Otherwise you have to say, you know, I have to gravitate toward everything.
I think the idli chapati thing is an understatement when you look at a relationship, you know.
No, sometimes understatements are good because they make you see the point.